that, of course, the beautiful sound of South Africa winning the Rugby World Cup on Saturday night and then lifting the trophy for the second time in a row. The Springboks are Rugby World Cup champions. What a game of rugby that was. 1 point in it, as was the case in the quarterfinals against France, as was the case in the semifinals against England. This surely the most memorable, most incredible Rugby World Cup triumph for the Springboks ever, simply because of the impossible journey they had to overcome to get to the final. This is the Inside Pass once again. My name is Lloyd Bernard, sports editor at News 24, and I'm joined again by Herman Mostert in the Cape Town studios. Morning, Herman.
Good morning, Lloyd.
The hangovers, both real and metaphorical, I think are real across South Africa today. It's been a heck of a weekend. You know, Saturday would have taken a lot out of people emotionally, physically watching that game. South Africans so invested in the Springboks, and geez, I mean, it really was down to the wire. Have you recovered from the weekend yet, Mostert?
Not in sleep, but yeah, pretty much. Look, yeah, it was like you said. You know, no one can blame the box of having an easy road to this title. You know, there may be a few question marks around 2019 and 2007. You know, they had much easier routes to the final, but this was as tough as it gets. You know, France, yeah, probably the best team at the tournament, and we had them in the quarterfinals. England 1 point win, and now New Zealand. You can't ask for a tougher road. Yeah. They obviously played Ireland in the group stages, and a pretty strong Scottish team as well. So there was no easy road, and somehow they just managed to get there. This ranks up there with the 95 win.
Yeah,
two big ones.
Today almost feels like just a little bit of a day of rest, because we had Saturday, which was just crazy. Yesterday, the reaction to it was crazy. And then they obviously arrive back tomorrow. So we're expecting the box at Orotambo tomorrow morning, just before lunch. And, you know, the scenes there will be, you know, hopefully chaotic, really. And as South Africa comes together to welcome them back. And then we know from 2019 what the streets of South Africa look like in the days that follow them returning. The trophy tour will be on again. So this is almost our half time, I feel like, of the Rugby World Cup final. You know, we've had the match, and now today we catch our breath. And then I think from tomorrow, the scenes around this country are going to be quite something. Sure, I felt, you know, confident in the first half, given the, even with the Bongi injury after 3 minutes, which was obviously a devastating blow to South Africa given their hooker situation. But the way they played after that, I kind of had this confidence. You know, you're going into halftime at 12-6, and yes, maybe you'd like to be a bit further ahead on the scoreboard there, but then the Sam Kane red card happens, and you think, you know, given how they've played in the first half, you really should be okay from here. I mean, my feeling at halftime was that they're going to be just fine here. You know, the numerical advantage is in play. They're already playing a bit better anyway, even 15 against 15. And just from what you've seen, it looks like they're going to do the business here. And then the second half happens and the whole mood changes.
Yeah, for me, I saw that momentum shift just before halftime, actually. Because it was 12-3, and then Kane went off with the red card.
Yeah.
And then you thought, this is it. You know, the All Blacks are done. Because even with 15 against 15, the Boks were, in that early parts of the game, the better team. I mean, they were smashing the All Blacks back in tackles. Pieter Steyn, obviously, at the forefront. And they had the All Blacks rattled. And thoroughly deserved to lead 12-3. And then the red card happens. And then, but just a little period before halftime for me, the All Blacks, that seemed to galvanize the All Blacks. They almost scored just before halftime, that brilliant tackle from Curdley Aronson, the try-saving tackle.
Yeah.
I think it was on Rikiwe Arani.
Yeah.
But then the All Blacks got a penalty, and it was 12-6, and then they went into halftime, and sort of the momentum a little bit changed a little bit there for me. But then in the early parts of the second half, the box had chances. Obviously, we had that one breakaway where Sia, you know, had Jesse Krul on his outside, and you had to pass there. It would have been 19-6.
Yeah.
And then after that, everything just changed, and yeah, they were just hanging on there for at the end.
Yeah, a couple of yellow cards as well. Sia himself getting a yellow card, and then obviously that Cheslin Kolbe yellow card, which just made for the most incredible television, because, you know, the hero of 2019 gets carded with 10 minutes to go in a World Cup final when his team's 1 point ahead, and it looks like he could become the villain of 2023. And he couldn't even watch the game. And I think those scenes of him hiding under his Bok jersey in tears, unable to watch those final moments will live long in the history of South African rugby. How big was Peter Steph du Toit? I mean, Rob Howing's player ratings on News 24, Peter Steph got a 9.5 out of 10. And I said to Rob, what did he do wrong? Where's he been doctor's half a point here? I mean, that was as close to the perfect rugby performance you'll ever see. And when you consider that it came in a Rugby World Cup final, I mean, that was just monstrous.
Yeah, like 28 tackles. I'm not sure about the stats, but I don't think there would have been too many test matches where a player have made more tackles than that. That's just a staggering amount. And also the intensity that of which some of those tackles, there was an early tackle that he made, I think it was on the winger, Bridge, which was sort of set the tone for the match. And it was on Barrett, actually, on Jordy Barrett.
Oh, yeah, that was huge. Yeah. That was huge.
And, I mean, it's been mentioned, you know, he played like it was his final rugby match or his final match ever for the Springboks. And remarkable. For me, you know, he's a player there. He had some criticism came his way earlier on in the season. People were saying that he was conceding a lot of penalties. He's maybe not the player he was 4 years ago. But he's, I mean, in this tournament, he's been absolutely superb. And I think we also mustn't forget with him, you know, remember he was a guy who almost lost his leg 3 years ago.
Yeah.
In a Super Rugby match where that was obviously well documented how close he actually came to having his leg amputated, and to come back now to being at the level where he is amazing.
Yeah. We want to go to Kaniso Chwaku, who was obviously in Paris for the final inside the stadium, and he returns home today after a 7-week journey in France where he's been following the box around. But before we do that, let's just hear what Siya Kolisi had to say after the Rugby World Cup final when he was addressing media in the post-match press conference.
What brings us together is our country. What brings us today together to play for is the Springbok and then South Africa. And that's what has been driving us. That's honestly that's been driving. And I can't explain it to you in words. You need to be a South African to understand. You need to come to South Africa and see it. It's a beautiful country with a lot of problems. But once we come together, and we've come together a lot before for a common goal, and I promise you, nothing can stop us as a country. And it's not just in sport. It's in life in general. It's in everyday work. And that's what we're trying to do, you know, each and every single day by giving everything. We're not saying we're going to win all the time, but we promise you we'll give it everything. And goals without hard work and effort means nothing. And we had to put in the hard work and sacrifice all the time to being away from our family. And, it couldn't have... I wouldn't change the script, how it's done, you know. And we, the friendship, I've known Jacques since I was 18 years old. I've known Coach Russ. He gave me my first contract. Me and Eben made when we were 17. We were sitting there before the game, and Eben was laughing. He's always serious before a game. He was smiling. He's like, what a great opportunity to be doing this with people that you come along with. France, Malaba, we all come from the same journey and area. And so it's real for us, you know. We care for each other, we care for our country, and I will do this over and over again.
Okay, gentlemen in the front.
Such powerful words from such a powerful and inspirational leader. I mean, Siya Kolisi has just been absolutely superb in the way he's led this team for 6 years now. We don't know what the future holds for him. Hopefully we get to see him playing many more tests for the box. Kaniso Chwaku in France, are you with us?
Yes, good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How you guys doing?
No, we're good, man. Are the bags packed? Are you ready to come home?
Yep. It's just what it is. What we've come here to do is done. The trophy is coming back to where it was. So, job done. So you look at the base plate, it's written there, New Zealand 2011, 2015 New Zealand, 2019 South Africa, 2018 South Africa. So it's going to turn to plastic clocks. By a tour. So from East London, then the trophy goes back to Platykloof, and then it will chill at Platykloof for another 3 and a bit years when it then has to go to Australia. So World Cup successfully defended. Point there. What matters is that the box won. How they won will be debated in years to come. The fact remains that they went to France and they won 6 out of 7 games. But the 6 out of the 7 that they won guaranteed them a defense of their World Cup.
Trucks, give us the sense of what it was like inside that stadium on Saturday night. I mean, the whole of South Africa looking on, holding their breath. You know, even through the television broadcast, just looked like the most tense game of rugby you will ever see. What was the mood and atmosphere like inside the stadium?
Look, firstly, we had quite a full media contingent to a point where we ran out of match programs. That'll tell you the interest that the game actually garnered. The atmosphere, unfortunately, the rain got in the way, but I think the atmosphere before the game would have been very festive. But it was a very festive inside. Then after kickoff, it got very tense. The crowd was difficult in that the locals did not know who to back because they don't like the All Blacks much. They still have an axe to grind with South Africa because of France being eliminated by South Africa in the quarterfinals. It was one of those where the fans, it didn't float. The only time they really did come together was when they did an absolutely quiet, magnificent set of the Mexican wave. Unfortunately, it just so happened that we were not allowed to take any videos of any pictures of anything that happened during the game from kickoff right until full time. But it was very tense. I mean, you could see even the TV analysts, your guys from Sky, your guys from Stan Sports, your guys from Super Sports, guys had clearly taken sides. And I mean, there's that one video of Sia with the fans saying, "Oh, Sia Kolisi." You could see Shimmy in the background. He is absolutely so happy. I mean, Jean de Villiers was sitting two desks away from us. He was absolutely happy in his problem. He tried to hide it a bit, but you know, when you walk down that path like he has, he wasn't there to play in 2007 because of a biceps injury, but he's a 2007 Rugby World Cup winner. He knows the feeling. He was there with the team when they won the World Cup. So I think for the players who've walked that path, it really matters. For South African journalists, it actually matters considering what had transpired in the week leading up with how the Mongi Onambi matter suddenly now became very personal. For parts of the English media. So it was very tense. It was tense in the media box. But it was also in good spirit because it was also congratulatory from the New Zealand press and parts of the English press that remained friendly.
And the hours after full-time, Trucks, I mean, what did those look like? What did the box do? How did they spend their time? What time did they leave the change room? We saw some amazing footage coming out of the change room with the likes of Roger Federer in there celebrating with the box. Just really special moments. What time would they have gotten out of there? I would imagine the party would have continued at the team hotel. I mean, probably some rather sensitive, delicate individuals come Sunday morning.
Well, they took a bit of time to get to the press conference, understandably so. For one, I missed the New Zealand press, the entire time of the New Zealand press conference. I actually watched the last part of it on the screen in the press box, in the media tribune, because I was busying myself watching the box celebrating with fans, celebrating with families, celebrating with players. I mean, for all of the families that came through, who sat in that lower bowl, I mean, it meant so much to them. Firstly, you looked at cost of those tickets. I mean, those lower bowl tickets, they cost 21,000 rand, those Category 1 tickets. So for them to be there to witness family, friends, getting to where they were, winning the tournament, I mean, it must have meant so much to them. They spent a long time on the field. They took in the applause. They left it in deservedly so because, I mean, they put in their Herculean effort to win the game. And then they went to the changing room and then they had their first clean, as we saw with the rendition of Zombie, which has now clearly been repossessed by South Africans. It's now Rassi. And then after that, Sir Police actually, when he came to the press conference, he was singing equally too. So he was singing to himself as he came in. And then when he put the trophy down, he like slouched back on the chair and just said, "Oh my God." And then great footage from SuperSport appeared where he was absolutely happy with the DC, where he says, "Kwali kwala glonina," which is like, yeah, this is not the time for cowards. So he was very elated. He was very happy. I mean, if you look back at the fact that he really didn't make the World Cup, so for him to be seated there with that trophy in front of him after a successful World Cup defense, when there was every possibility of him not making it, it meant so much for Sia. I think also there wasn't enough time to actually delve into what that World Cup meant for him. Hopefully it's a question that he'll be able to answer when they land at OR Tambo tomorrow when they have the press conference at midday. So we'll see how that will pan out. But I mean, when he said this flashback, Jacques remained Jacques, stoic Jacques, even though maybe he's offered a little of a bit of emotion. But Sia made it clear that he was very happy to be on the winning side of the World Cup.
Kaniso, how are you doing?
I'm good, Herman. How are you doing?
Great, thanks. Listen, talk to us a bit about Russia. You know, it's been all about Jacques and Sia. You know, they were all up for press. It sort of feels like Russia has been a bit in the background. You know, he didn't like to, you know, steal the limelight. You know, when the players lifted the trophy, I saw Russia was right at the back. He wasn't, you know, center and forward. Was Russia pretty low key? Obviously, there's been some clips of him being very emotional right at the final whistle. But how do you think he went about things on Saturday?
What's key about Rassie Erasmus is that when the team needed him to front up, especially when you look at the week leading up to the England game, he did two unprecedented for him. He did two media conferences. He did one that was virtual and one that was physical on the Monday and the Tuesday. Now, what was interesting in that, especially with what transpired with the Mbonge Bonambi alleged racial slur, he chose to take a back seat. And at first, it came across as if the current coaches are being hung out to dry. Also, it's like we could have and should have handled that matter a bit better. They only really started to respond to the crisis better late in the week, where they made it clear at the top of the press conference that the Mbonge matter is with World Rugby and it won't be discussed. Whereas on the Monday, they absolutely, well, I felt that Don Himona absolutely hung out to dry, even though he was prepared. But when the English media starts to shower you with those questions, I mean, it's simply sometimes you have no way out. But I think he stood back and let the guys who've been at the forefront of the team get the glory. I mean, Don Himona was put up. Felix Jones was put up. I mean, we had Dion on Sunday. So all the guys who are actually at the core front, at the core face of the team, I mean, it was Dion on the Sunday, Don on Monday, Felix on Tuesday, Jacques on Thursday, Sick on Friday, and then it was Sick again. It was Jacques on post-match, and then yesterday was Dion David. So effectively, it was all about the guys who do the hard yards. Whereas when the pressure's on the team, it's then Rassie who's appeared and made sure that he is the one who then takes everything that is supposed to be going to the team and then lays it on him.
Mm. Trucks, thank you so much for joining us. I know you've got a long flight ahead of you to get back to South Africa. We're looking forward to having you back with us, and just well done again on a fantastic 7 weeks. I trust it was the experience of a lifetime, and we'll be seeing you soon and I'm sure you'll have a much needed break when you get back. But thanks so much.
Thank you very much, guys.
Cool. Well, so that man is tired. He's been going for a while. Look, some big decisions taken throughout the course of the tournament from Rassie and Jacques. And, you know, the hooker thing we spoke about a bit earlier, it almost backfired in a sense that there were some line-out troubles with Dion Ferry. And I think they were picking off. They knew Dion Ferry's going to go front, you know, and they kind of picked it off quite easily. And scrums, they were reading it quite well. Scrums, you know, we never really had that dominance at the scrum that we might have had if Bongi was on the field. But now that it's all said and done, all of those little gambles and strange calls that they made, I mean, obviously paid off 7-1 in the final. And the big one, I mean, bringing Andre Pollard back the way they did, I mean, proved to be a masterstroke. Yes, tough on Marnie Libok, but I mean, the way Andre Pollard kicked in the final and didn't miss a kick throughout the knockouts.
Well, yeah, he didn't miss a kick at the whole tournament. He had 13 kicks and he kicked all 13. In hindsight now, obviously, you don't want to... it's not nice to see a player get injured, but... Malcolm Marx's knee injury probably and proved to be a blessing in disguise, because obviously that allowed them to pick Pollard. I still can't understand why Pollard wasn't part of the original 33-man squad. I mean, he was very close to being fit, and it was still some time out from when they had to play their first match. And I mean, he wouldn't have needed to play the first match in any case. So, a bit still puzzling. I guess we'll never know the answer to that. But it all ended well, you know. They had to, considering the conditions that they faced on Saturday, Pollard was the right option to play. And, you know, four kicks at goal, slotted all four. I actually thought the first two kicks on Saturday, he didn't strike it that well, actually, but it still
Yeah.
But, yeah, he found his groove soon again. And at the end, you know, that was the difference in the match. You know, the All Blacks did really well to get back into it, and they started dominating the contest. And then they had chances, obviously, with Colby's slap down that penalty, but it was a long-range one. Although Barrett had the distance, it was just off target. And then there was another, obviously, Richie Mungo missed the one conversion from the touchline as well. So that's obviously, that proved the difference. At the end, we said, like, after the match we lost to Ireland, there were 11 points that we missed off the boot. And we said that's the reason why we lost. And, you know, we said we can't go into a knockout game if you can't kick your goals. And at the end, that's what won us the final.
Yeah, geez, that Jordy Barrett one in the, what was that, about 74th minute or something. Mm. You just had a bad feeling about that. I mean, as soon as that arm went up for the penalty, and you saw Barrett lying up, you went, oh, because that had been coming, you know, the whole half there, they'd be clawing their way back. And I just thought, oh, no, that's it, gone. Lungani Zama, one of our freelancers, just written an absolutely beautiful piece that News 24 is leading with today that really just sums up the gravity of what this World Cup means to South Africa and just how deep every one of the players had to dig to get over the line. We're going to hear some of that piece now.
Hope truly does come from the unlikeliest places, as long as you are prepared to seek it. Of course, when it came down to it, many of our hopes rested on the boot of one Andre Pollard. His playmaking peaks may be in the autumn, but Pollard was always here on one primary mission, to be the calm, especially in the moments that matter most. He didn't blink. He didn't flinch. He didn't miss. Not once. 12 times in 4 games, he put the ball on a tee. 12 times he chiseled his jaw, took a few short steps, and swung a boot that was bred for exactly that. 12 times he trotted back to his brothers, having restored order to the scoreboard. 100%, they are calling him. Of course, there are many other unsung heroes within the squad. They do what the likes of Quagga Smith did in 2019. Dirt trackers, diligently studying the opposition, carrying water buckets and team morale, and sharpening the brothers whose turn it is to play. Every one of them is a champion. And just as Smith, the servant from 2019, became the finisher in France, so too will the next batch graduate.
It's a lovely piece from Lungani Zama that you can go and read on News 24 today. But it really was a squad effort. I mean, I think that's what he was saying there as well. You know, it's, yes, there were the heroic performances of Peter Steph Du Toit. You know, you had Andre Pollard, who was just ice cool and did a huge job. But I mean, no one really had a bad game on Saturday, right? I mean, if you look at how those guys, you know, performed at different moments, they all were required to stand up and do something really important, and it was proper squad effort to get over the line.
I think I actually wanted to mention this. The one unsung hero of this tournament is Quagga Smith. Every single time he's come on, he's made a difference, and he's made an impact on coming on off from the bench. There were two very vital turnovers that he won against New Zealand on Saturday that the All Blacks were camped deep inside South African territory, and he won the ball back there for South Africa, which, I mean, you could argue that saved the match for us. And he's done that not once, but on a number of occasions in this tournament. And he was superb when he came on. But so is most of the subs. You know, they kept telling us, you know, it's not about the 15 players on the field. It's a 23-man or maybe, you know, 33-man effort. You know, it's a whole squad effort. And they've been emphasizing that the whole tournament. And it's proven that way. You know, it's not about just a certain few individuals. It's about the whole squad effort. But yeah, a guy like Quagga, really, I think he deserves mention. I think he flies a little bit under the radar, maybe. Mm. But he was absolutely superb.
Yeah, it's also why, you know, if you think at how meticulous they've been in creating that depth, ensuring that the journey to the Rugby World Cup title in 2023 is one they started a long time ago. You know, there's planning involved there that that deepens the pool of quality, and you're giving opportunities to players along the way. And because of that, there's a lot of, you know, chopping and changing and selection in the sense of getting the minutes into players that you need before the final. And because of that, there's not a lot of consistency in the build up to the tournament in terms of what the, I mean, we were talking a few weeks ago about, you know, do they even know what their best 15 is, you know, because of the options that they have. And I suppose when you look at it that way, it's in a way understandable that Eben Etzebeth is the only player included in a in the World Rugby, you know, team of the year, starting 15 team of the year. Only one South African in that side, which is difficult to accept in a way because South Africa are world champions. But, you know, when you look at how, you know, for example, a Jesse Creel might have had a great World Cup, but, you know, how much of the build-up did he play? How much rugby did he play in 2023? So I think that's why, you know, we have to accept that team looks the way it does. I mean, I don't know what your thoughts were on the awards. I mean, people are saying South Africa were snubbed, but I mean, even Andy Farrell, coach of the year, I mean, they went on such a great run of 17 tests in a row in 2023. You know, the Boks lost games in 2023 because they were trying different things, and you know, Eben obviously misses out on player of the year as well. But I mean, I don't really have an issue with the way the World Rugby Awards turned out.
No, just looking at this team, this 1-15, the dream team, you know, obviously a lot of Bok fans are upset about this, but like there's some really good players that are picked in that team, and Eben obviously he's there. But look, I actually can look at this team and I can't find a spot for any other South African player. And it's exactly like you said, you know, they don't pick the same team every week. So you can't sort of build up that consistency. So, but it's you know, obviously it's massive in our favor that we have such great depth in our game and in our team. But that just means that you're not going to have the same team play every week. And that makes it tough if you have to pick a team of the year to actually pick a lot of those players, because a lot of them haven't played. You know, obviously, you know, like a guy like Andre Pollard is now, you know, he's played a big role in helping us winning a World Cup, but he's only played like 3 or 4 matches this whole year, you know? So you can't put him now in the World Rugby's team of the year. And I think that's just, people need to take a little bit of emotion out of this and think, listen, this is not a World Cup team. This is a world team of the year, a dream team.
Don't take it so personally, guys. You've got the trophy that matters.
I think you can maybe argue, Eben Etzebeth maybe deserved the player of the year ahead of Savia because he won. I think it was touch and go between those two, and Eben obviously ended up winning the final, so maybe that should have gone to him.
Yeah.
But the others, you know,
he was big in the quarterfinal as well. I mean, just huge.
Yeah. I mean, the other awards, Andy Farrell, I mean, Ireland won it. This was the best Irish team ever. They won 17 test matches in a row.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was such a close game against New Zealand in the quarterfinals. So, I mean, I think they deserve credit for that. I think Ireland's time will come in future. They've got great structures in their game and some decent, they're almost a bit like the Springboks. You know, there's a great core group there that I think they can go far in 4 years' time. So I don't think it's this outrageous as people are making it out to be, but maybe I'm wrong, who knows.
Two more questions for you, Mostert, before we wrap, and they're both very important. The first one, is this the greatest Bok team ever?
Jeez, that's a tough one to answer. I think if you want to, you know, compare them to 95, like I've mentioned, I think this team or this tournament win is up there with the 95 win. To take nothing away from the 2007 and the 2019 groups, I just don't think their roads to the title were as hard as these two have been. Obviously, 95, we played Australia, who came here as world number one. They came here as defending champs. We quite beat them quite comfortably in the opening game at Newlands. We played a very strong French team in the semis. Then, obviously, incredibly strong New Zealand team in that final. And this is similar, you know, we beat a French team. I still think people could crucify me for this, but I still think France are the best team in the world at the moment, you know. But that doesn't mean that you're always going to win a World Cup. It doesn't mean the best team always wins. You know, we played them in the quarterfinals and we snuck out a 1-point win. You know, if that match was replayed the next day, the French probably would have won comfortably. But that's how it works in sport. That's why it's called a World Cup, and that's why it's called a cup. You know, it's a knockout thing. It's on the day. You can perform in those 80 minutes. So, but, you know, to look at them doing that 3 weeks in a row, going, you know, France 1 point, England 1 point, New Zealand one point, you know, historically speaking, you can't get a tougher road to a World Cup final. So, yeah, there've been some, you know, it's obviously subjective exercise, but this team would probably rank up there in the top three of the best ever BOC teams.
Yeah. Finally, you know, and SA Rugby have already said they're not in a rush to replace Jacques, but, you know, that's a reality that the BOCs have to consider now. This is the end of an era, and it's ended in the best possible way with back-to-back Rugby World Cups. But Jacques Nienaber is out, and there will be a new head coach of the Springboks the next time they play rugby. What do you think they're going to do? It's early days, but, you know, if you had to speculate now in terms of the direction, do you think it'll be someone external, or do you think they'll keep it internal? Will Rassie still be involved?
Listening from what has come out of the squad, it's clear now that they're not going to be in a rush to name a new coach, to name a replacement. Rassie's obviously still the director of rugby. And I wouldn't be surprised if Rassie ends up being the coach again, you know, for the time being, if they can't find a suitable candidate. They've also hinted that it could come out of the current group of assistants. Obviously, Dion Davids and Zwandile Stick, their names have been mentioned. You know, a lot of people say, yeah, but, you know, they haven't got enough head coach experience. But Jacques also didn't have any head coach experience, you could argue. Obviously, Don Heman is part of that as well. He's the scrum. But I think he's going to be the head coach. But, I mean, there are guys there, and they've said that this needs to be sort of a succession plan in the sense that they want to, you know, bring the guy. Rassie has talked about his elite player development thing, and the same goes for the coaches, you know. That's essentially why he's the director of rugby. He, you know, he likes to streamline things in that way. So, look, at the moment, it looks like it's going to come from in that core group, or maybe Rassie stays as head coach again. You know, because, I mean, he's still heavily involved in coaching, being part of the coaching setup. You know, it's not like a silent director of rugby that you could sometimes have, you know, a guy that's not even part of the match day's team and all the match day preparations and everything. He's sort of more a CEO type of guy. But so it depends on what your director of rugby actually does. And, I'd be very surprised if it comes someone from outside, because then that would go sort of against the grain of what they've done. And that guy would not be familiar with the way things work and the structures and the systems and everything. So, but then again, you also have to ask the question, you know, how long is Rassie going to be part of SA Rugby for? Obviously, his contract is it 24?
25, 20, yeah.
At the end of 2025, his contract runs out. So that's the halfway mark towards the next World Cup. So we'll have to see what happens. Obviously, Jock is now going to Ireland. I've said before on this program that I wouldn't be surprised if Rassie follows Jock eventually to Ireland. You'll see. I think for now, we shouldn't expect the Springbok coach to be named this year, I don't think.
No, I wouldn't think so. Guys, it's just been the most incredible 7 weeks. We've loved absolutely every second of it. And the Springboks just doing what they did in 2019 and pulling this country together. Cannot wait to see what South Africa looks like over the next few days after the BOCs return home victorious. South Africa are top of the rugby world. They are ranked number one in the world. They are world champions. They are the first team in the history of the game to get to 4 Rugby World Cups. If you are South African and a Springbok fan, things can't really get better for you right now. We're going to play out with another little piece of Lungani Zama's wonderful column for us, and it's focused, I think, on Kirtley Orensa, one of the emerging heroes from the BOC Rugby World Cup squad, and how he dug deep to keep South Africa in the game during a crucial moment against the All Blacks in Saturday's final. Thank you so much for joining us on the Inside Pass. We'll chat again soon. All the best and cheers.
Naturally, there were green and gold heroes scattered everywhere. Peter Steph Du Toit played as if he had been told he would never wear the BOC jersey again. He tore into everything in black like a maniac. A magnificent, mom's remade man of the match maniac. Little Kirtley Orensa's timely tackle on Big Rico Ioane on the brink of half-time needs to find a home at the Louvre. It was that priceless, that precise. It was that necessary. But it would need to be on a large canvas, because the frame would also have to include the breathless insurance provided by Cheslin Kolbe fully committed to backing up his fellow wing, just in case. Perhaps then it would be more fitting as a mural. You can see it now, splashed somewhere overlooking the stupa that raised Arinsa, readying him to rise to the challenge of the biggest game in the world.